Blog Talk Radio.
A growing economy that creates good middle-class jobs, that must be the North Star that guides our efforts. Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living?
Good Sunday evening. It is 7 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., so that means it is time for Making Sense with Steve Blazer. I'm your host, Steve Blazer, and I thank you for deciding to spend a part of your evening with me. Now, before I get into today's program, I've got a couple of quick announcements. First, the last show, over 70,000 of you tuned in either live or to listen to the archive of the show. And to all you who listen, thank you very much. I'm truly humbled by your support. I announced last week that I was in negotiations with one or more NBC radio affiliates to air my show on their stations. I've executed an agreement with one so far, and that is KCAA 1050 AM radio out of Loma Linda in the Inland Empire area of California, which borders on eastern Los Angeles. Starting March 4th, they will air my show on Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. They will also be making it available on their website via podcast and a number of other technologies, including video, so that my shows can be heard anytime you want to hear them, and you can see me as well as hear me deliver the show, if you like. So, yes, we are going to simultaneously produce the show on video, and I'll talk more about that in coming episodes of the show. We've got a great show for you tonight, including segments on full coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm going to talk about how the GOP war on women continues into 2013, and then we're going to have an update on the attempt to have Chuck Hagel confirmed as Secretary of Defense. After which, of course, we will have our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to call in and talk with me, please do so. The call-in number for the show is 917-889-3891. I'll try to get you in, but as always, that is subject to time constraints, and we have a really packed show today, so I apologize if I can't get to any of you callers. So let's get started with full coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. Now, this past Tuesday, the president issued his 2013 State of the Union address, a part of which I played as the introduction to today's show. The president covered a wide range of issues, but there was a definite focus on the economy and jobs. Now, I want to go through 9 major portions of the State of the Union address. I really want to go through it fully. I think it's important to take a close look at the address because it covers the president's vision not just for 2013, but really for his entire second term. I also think it should be compared with what we get from Republicans in terms of any vision at all that they might put forth for this country regarding the major challenges of our time. I mean, do Republicans have any ideas for creating jobs? Do they have any ideas for making our people more employable in terms of giving them the education and skills that they need to be more attractive to an employer? Those are some of the questions that I think are fair to think about and ask ourselves and others when we listen to the State of the Union and over the next 4 years. Now, the president spoke several times about how the upcoming battle over the sequester would affect the economy. The sequester are those harsh mandatory cuts that will go into effect in the next few weeks if another solution is not passed by Congress. Let's listen.
In 2011, Congress passed a law saying that if both parties couldn't agree on a plan to reach our deficit goal, about $1 trillion worth of budget cuts would automatically go into effect this year. These sudden, harsh, arbitrary cuts would jeopardize our military readiness. They devastate priorities like education and energy and medical research. They would certainly slow our recovery and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs. And that's why Democrats, Republicans, business leaders, and economists have already said that these cuts, known here in Washington as the sequester, are a really bad idea. Now, some in Congress have proposed preventing only the defense cuts by making even bigger cuts to things like education and job training, Medicare, and Social Security benefits. That idea is even worse.
The president is so right. And the evidence for what he was talking about was what happened in the fourth quarter last year. Spending was down due to Superstorm Sandy and due to cuts in defense. And that changed the economy from expanding at 3% in the third quarter of 2012 to a 0.1% contraction in the fourth quarter. Cutting spending is a dangerous thing to do to a recovering economy. Paul Krugman talks about this all the time. And I hope Republicans do not force us all to relearn that lesson the hard way. If the Republicans in the House allow the cuts in the sequester to go forward as is, I'm going to predict right now that when the economic data for the next period comes out, it will involve a several point contraction in GDP, and we will start shedding jobs again. I almost think that's what Republicans want. I really do. I think that sometimes. I think maybe they want the economy to do so badly under President Obama that it completely hurts his legacy, and that's also their strategy to take back the White House in 2016. So, you know, we have to watch for that. Are they going to actively work to hurt the economy? We'll have to see. For his part, the president talked about his vision for an economy that grows jobs, and he reminded us all, including the Republicans he was facing, that he has a jobs plan out there that the Congress has not fully passed. Let's listen.
But let's be clear. Deficit reduction alone is not an economic plan. A growing economy that creates good middle-class jobs, that must be the North Star that guides our efforts. Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living? A year and a half ago, I put forward an American Jobs Act that independent economists said would create more than 1 million new jobs. And I thank the last Congress for passing some of that agenda. I urge this Congress to pass the rest. But tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime. It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth. That's what we should be looking for.
So there are two things there. For Republicans who like to make charges that Democrats are for big government, they're not getting that there. The president is proposing job-creating changes that are deficit neutral. That's one important point. The other important point is that Republicans have no job creation plan. The only thing on the Republican agenda is deficit reduction. But as the president said at the beginning of that piece, deficit reduction alone is not an economic plan, and it is not going to create jobs. And it's not going to grow the economy. And that goes to the next part of the president's address that I want to talk about. There are two main things that make a first world economy like those of the United States and Western Europe different from those in a third world economy. That's a better educated populace and a strong infrastructure that supports business and commerce. Now, we in America have been shamefully neglecting both of those for the last 40 years or so since Reagan was elected. President Obama talked about this and proposed a new program designed to address it. Let's listen.
America's energy sector is just one part of an aging infrastructure badly in need of repair. Ask any CEO where they'd rather locate and hire. A country with deteriorating roads and bridges, or one with high-speed rail and internet, high-tech schools, self-healing power grids? The CEO of Siemens America, a company that brought hundreds of new jobs to North Carolina, said that if we upgrade our infrastructure, they'll bring even more jobs. And that's the attitude of a lot of companies all around the world. And I know you want these job-creating projects in your district. I've seen all those ribbon cuttings. So, tonight, I propose a fix-it-first program to put people to work as soon as possible on our most urgent repairs, like the nearly 70,000 structurally deficient bridges across the country. And to make sure taxpayers don't shoulder the whole burden, I'm also proposing a partnership to rebuild America that attracts private capital to upgrade what our businesses need most. Modern ports to move our goods. Modern pipelines to withstand a storm. Modern schools worthy of our children. Let's prove there's no better place to do business than here in the United States of America, and let's start right away. We can get this done.
Now, Republicans like to make light of efforts to improve our infrastructure. But if you have bad roads and bridges, people can't get to your facility to work there or buy goods there. The goods produced can't be transported to market. If you have a weak electrical grid or telecommunications infrastructure, any businesses that require computers or the internet will be adversely affected. Now, these things and other similar infrastructure issues require constant and consistent investment. America's infrastructure is falling behind that of Western Europe, and it's affecting our ability to be competitive. Now, ironically, I think this is the measure that is least likely to receive Republican support. Republicans claim to know more about jobs and how to conduct business than Democrats, but neglecting infrastructure certainly doesn't lend any credibility to that claim. Now, second of the least likely ideas to receive Republican support is the president's suggestion about climate change. That's why when the president talked about climate change, he said a couple of things to deal with that. Let's listen.
But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change. Now, it's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 15. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late. Now, the good news is we can make meaningful progress on this issue while driving strong economic growth. I urge this Congress to get together, pursue a bipartisan, market-based solution to climate change, like the one John McCain and Joe Lieberman worked on together a few years ago. But if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy.
So in addition to making the case for the fact that climate change exists and providing some evidence and background, the president reached out and touted his efforts to be bipartisan by reminding people that he has suggested a market way forward in the past that was market-based and had received support from both Joe Lieberman and John McCain. But the president also made it clear he's not going to stop working on this issue if Republicans in Congress decide to try to obstruct him. He's going to move forward with executive orders designed to combat climate change if the Republicans do not intend to be part of the solution here. Now, efforts to turn back climate change are about protecting our future so that, in fact, we have one. In terms of making that future better, assuming it comes, the president talked about a number of ways to make our workers more competitive in the future. One of those was about early childhood education. The president wants every child in school starting at age 4 or the year prior to kindergarten in the U.S., which typically is at 5 years old. Let's listen.
You know, study after study shows that the sooner a child begins learning, the better he or she does down the road. But today, fewer than 3 in 10 4-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. So tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America. That's something we should be able to do. Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on by boosting graduation rates, reducing teen pregnancy, even reducing violent crime. In states that make it a priority to educate our youngest children, like Georgia or Oklahoma, studies show students grow up more likely to read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families of their own. We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance.
What more can you say about this other than it makes sense? We should give the children of this country every opportunity to grow up to be successful. This is an investment. You know that word, right, Republicans? Investment. You spend some now and you aim to get a higher return later. The president said, and he's right, that every dollar you spend now on pre-K education saves an average of $7 later on. Now, that's a good investment as far as I'm concerned. The president also talked about raising the minimum wage to $9 per hour. Now, talk of raising the minimum wage always causes much wailing and gnashing of teeth among Republicans, particularly among the conservative punditry, many of whom will make $9 a minute. But let's hear President Obama on raising the minimum wage.
We know our economy is stronger when we reward an honest day's work with honest wages. But today, a full-time worker making the minimum wage earns $14,500 a year, even with the tax relief we put in place. A family with two kids that earns the minimum wage still lives below the poverty line. That's wrong. That's why, since the last time this Congress raised the minimum wage, 19 states have chosen to bump theirs even higher. Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. We should be able to get that done. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families. It could mean the difference between groceries or the food bank, rent or eviction, scraping by or finally getting ahead. For businesses across the country, it would mean customers with more money in their pockets. And a whole lot of folks out there would probably need less help from government. In fact, working folks shouldn't have to wait year after year for the minimum wage to go up while CEO pay has never been higher. So here's an idea that Governor Romney and I actually agreed on last year. Let's tie the minimum wage to the cost of living so that it finally becomes a wage you can live on.
Bill, we always hear the same things from Republicans in response to raising the minimum wage, and this time was no different. The Republican punditry came out in the days following the address and said these things. Republicans are talking about how it will harm job growth and how it is so horrible for business owners to have to pay $9 an hour for an honest day's work. Now, I will say this. In the short term, there is some very limited validity to what they are saying. But guess what? When you pay people on the lower end of the working class wage scale more money, what do they do with it? They spend it. Where do they spend it? They spend it in the business establishments of those businesses paying the minimum wage or higher, who make back all and more of the additional wage they just paid. People have to earn money in order to spend it. What do Republicans think, that the money vanishes once it's earned? That it vaporizes and eliminated for the economy? No. These folks who are essentially impoverished spend it almost right away on either food, clothing, shelter, or transportation, or childcare. That money immediately goes into their local economy. So it's stimulating as well as the right thing for lower income people. Speaking of vulnerable people, the president also talked about his efforts to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now, this is probably the second least controversial measure the president talked about all night, after the part where he praised the troops, and I'll get to that in a minute. The president praised strong bipartisan efforts to get immigration reform passed. Let's listen.
Our economy is stronger when we harness the talents and ingenuity of striving, hopeful immigrants. And right now, leaders from the business, labor, law enforcement, faith communities, they all agree that the time has come to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get it done. Now's the time to get it done. Real reform means stronger border security, and we can build on the progress my administration's already made, putting more boots on the southern border than at any time in our history, and reducing illegal crossings to their lowest levels in 40 years. Real reform means establishing a responsible pathway to earned citizenship, a path that includes passing a background check, paying taxes and a meaningful penalty, learning English, and going to the back of the line behind the folks trying to come here legally. And real reform means fixing the legal immigration system to cut waiting periods and attract the highly skilled entrepreneurs and engineers that will help create jobs and grow our economy. In other words, we know what needs to be done. And as we speak, bipartisan groups in both chambers are working diligently to draft a bill, and I applaud their efforts. So let's get this done. Send me a comprehensive immigration reform bill in the next few months, and I will sign it right away, and America will be better for it. Let's get it done. Let's get it done.
You heard all the applause. The one remarkable thing here wasn't what the president said or the general reaction. It was Speaker Boehner's visual reaction. The general reaction to this part of the president's address was enthusiastic applause, but Speaker Boehner sat there stone-faced and did not react. I'm personally taking that to believe that he doesn't agree with reforming immigration, and I don't quite think that my fellow Latinos will forget that anytime soon. The president also talked about the winding down of the Afghan war and saluted the efforts of our troops to bring a level of stability to that country that we all hope will allow the Afghan army to take over. Let's listen.
Tonight we stand united in saluting the troops and civilians who sacrifice every day to protect us. Because of them, we can say with confidence that America will complete its mission in Afghanistan and achieve our objective of defeating the core of Al-Qaeda. Already, we have brought home 33,000 of our brave servicemen and women. This spring, our forces will move into a support role while Afghan security forces take the lead. Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over. Beyond 2014, America's commitment to a unified and sovereign Afghanistan will endure. But the nature of our commitment will change. We're negotiating an agreement with the Afghan government that focuses on two missions: training and equipping Afghan forces so that the country does not again slip into chaos, and counterterrorism efforts that allow us to pursue the remnants of Al-Qaeda and their affiliates.
Now, obviously, this is another of the less controversial aspects of the address. Now, I hope that Afghanistan can solve its issues and have lasting periods of peace and prosperity, free of religious fundamentalism and respecting of its female citizens. Only time will tell. Now, finally, I want to talk about the president's statements on gun control. This was a really emotional part of the address. The president had several people attending who were survivors of past gun massacres and relatives of those who lost their lives in past gun massacres. It's a little bit of a long segment, but stay with it. This is the last piece of the State of the Union that I'm going to cover. We'll go right into the GOP's war on women afterwards. So let's listen.
Of course, what I've said tonight matters little if we don't come together to protect our most precious resource, our children. It has been 2 months since Newtown. I know this is not the first time this country has debated how to reduce gun violence. But this time is different. Overwhelming majorities of Americans, Americans who believe in the Second Amendment, have come together around common sense reform, like background checks that will make it harder for criminals to get their hands on a gun. Senators of both parties are working together on tough new laws to prevent anyone from buying guns for resale to criminals. Police chiefs are asking our help to get weapons of war and massive ammunition magazines off our streets because these police chiefs, they're tired of seeing their guys and gals being outgunned. Each of these proposals deserves a vote in Congress. If you want to vote no, that's your choice. But these proposals deserve a vote. Because in the 2 months since Newtown, more than 1,000 birthdays, graduations, anniversaries have been stolen from our lives by a bullet from a gun. More than 1,000. One of those we lost was a young girl named Hydea Pendleton. She was 15 years old. She loved Fig Newtons and lip gloss. She was a majorette. She was so good to her friends, they all thought they were her best friend. Just 3 weeks ago, she was here in Washington with her classmates, performing for her country at my inauguration. And a week later, she was shot and killed in a Chicago park after school, just a mile away from my house. Idea's parents, Nate and Cleo, are in this chamber tonight, along with more than 24 Americans whose lives have been torn apart by gun violence. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. They deserve a vote. Gabby Giffords deserves a vote. The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
Now, what more can you say other than the president's right? I mean, those folks who have lost so much, they deserve a vote. And the measures that the president is challenging Congress to allow a vote on are not grab-your-guns measures. They're common-sense measures to reduce gun violence, supported in most cases by 70% of NRA members. We need to support the president to get this done and get started reducing the gun violence in this country. Now, this State of the Union address was full of substantive policy positions and pronouncements. As I said at the start of this segment, it's an important address to really take in and understand, because this is the agenda for the next 4 years. This is where the president wants to take us. Now, I feel good about my vote for the president upon hearing the items that I highlighted and others like offers to work towards a diplomatic solution with Iran and the urge to pass the Violence Against Women Act, which I'll talk more about later, and a host of other issues. I think the State of the Union will be strong with Barack Obama at the helm fighting for these issues. You're listening to Making Sense with Steve Lazor. And now on to an update on women's rights and the Violence Against Women Act. In the 2012 presidential election, Barack Obama beat Mitt Romney in the women's vote by 12 points. Democrats have won the women's vote every presidential election for the last 24 years. In fact, you have to go back to 1988 to find a year where Republicans won the women's vote. You can determine, in fact, who will win a presidential election if you know by how much of a percentage of the women's vote the Democratic candidate will get over the Republican candidate. If it's less than 8 points, the Democrat's going to lose. If it's more than 8 points, the Democratic candidate's going to win. If it's exactly 8 points, it's a toss-up. Now, Republicans came away from election 2012 with the realization that they had some demographic problems. I've talked about this a number of times on my show, about the 180-degree turn Republicans have done with regards to immigration reform in an effort to reduce the advantage Democrats currently enjoy with Latino voters. Women punished the Republican Party in 2012 for things like casual remarks about rape and efforts to redefine rape. They also punished the GOP for transvaginal ultrasounds being forced on them if they want an abortion. And they punished the GOP and its standard bearer for binders full of women and other anti-women statements and positions. Taken collectively, these anti-women statements and positions, and more of them, constitute what I and many others term a Republican war on women. Now, so far, we've seen no effort by the GOP to alter their approach to women's issues to deal with their problems with the female electorate. Women seem to be joining African Americans on the list of demographics Republicans are writing off. Now, no more is that evident than the vote on the Violence Against Women Act in the Senate. When the vote to reauthorize the 1994 law was held this past Tuesday, 22 Republicans voted not to extend a law that has helped to protect millions of women against domestic violence and abuse. In fact, the law has reduced domestic violence within intimate partners by over 67% since 1993. As the USA Today reported, the act provides grants to state and local authorities for legal assistance, transitional housing, law enforcement training, stalker databases, and domestic violence hotlines. Legislation includes a provision that would speed up the analysis of DNA evidence in rape cases. There's now a rape kit backlog estimated at 400,000, with evidence that might link an assailant to a victim now sitting on a police department shelves for months and even years. Now, the version of the bill that was passed on Tuesday also contains an amendment by Leahy reauthorizing a law that funds programs to combat human trafficking both inside the country and around the world. So this is the law that 22 out of 45 Republican senators voting, that's nearly half of the Republican senators who voted, 22 out of 45 Republican senators voted against this bill, the Violence Against Women Act. They are Barrasso from Wyoming, Blunt from Montana, Boozman from Arkansas, Coburn from Oklahoma, Cornyn from Texas, Cruz from Texas, Enzi from Wyoming, Graham from South Carolina, Grassley from Iowa, Hatch from Utah, Inhoff from Oklahoma, Johans from Nebraska, Johnson from Wisconsin, Lee from Utah, McConnell from Kentucky, Paul from Kentucky, Rish from Idaho, Roberts from Kansas, Rubio from Florida, Scott from South Carolina, Sessions from Alabama, and Thune from South Dakota. Now, conspicuously present on the list of Republicans who voted nay are at least two Republicans expected to run for president in 2016, including Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky and Senator Marco Rubio from Florida. Now, can anyone imagine the guys who just voted against the Violence Against Women Act doing better than Mitt Romney in the women's vote if they run for president? I don't think so. Women are not going to forgive or forget Mr. Rand or Mr. Rubio's vote on this bill. I think they would do worse than Mitt Romney with the women's vote. I think those two senators are done as far as presidential ambition is concerned, and they deserve to be. That wasn't all that happened in the last 2 weeks in the Republican war on women. 2 weeks ago, Michigan legislators were well on their way to joining Virginia and Texas with passing a law that would have mandated that women running on abortion receive a transvaginal ultrasound. I've talked about this before, but in case you haven't heard about these before now, a transvaginal ultrasound is a rather larger, sizable device that is put inside a woman's vagina and uses sound waves to provide a picture of what's going on in her reproductive organs. Now, the idea behind these laws is to punish women who want to receive an abortion. And such laws often require the doctor to describe the fetus that they see to the woman in a final measure of humiliation to try to get them to change their minds about the abortion. Now, we can cut to the chase and call this what this is. It's state-sponsored and mandated rape. When you put something or you touch the reproductive organs of somebody against their will, that's rape. Now, Michigan would have passed the law 2 weeks ago if not for their Speaker of House, who I recognized in my Hall of Fame last week. He was a Republican Speaker of the House, so don't ever say that I'm not fair. When Republicans do something right, I mention it. But without that Speaker of the House who courageously stood up to his party, that law would be law in Michigan right now. Now, this week, it's the Republicans in Wisconsin who are going down the transvaginal highway. Tara Culp Pressler of Think Progress reports that at the Wisconsin Right to Life Legislative Conference this week, the state's top Republican lawmakers assured attendees that they will do everything in their power to enact a forced ultrasound bill. So, according to them, as a matter of fact, this bill is a priority. It's long overdue, said Wisconsin's Republican State Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. And I said last week, Republicans love to do this to women. I don't understand it, but they really love to hurt women. They can't seem to stand going a few weeks without doing something to hurt women in some way. But I always get angry responses and emails from Republicans when I assert there's a Republican war on women. No, we're supposed to believe that Republicans who propose and vote for bills that force women to unnecessarily get a device shoved up their vaginas against their will for wanting a medical procedure, we're supposed to think Republicans are doing that because they love women. Yeah. Well, let no one ever love me that much, please. Now, all that's bad, but unfortunately there was more in the GOP's latest salvos in the war on women from last week. As reported by TPM, two prominent conservative activist groups, FreedomWorks and the Heritage Group, joined the effort on the Republican side to fight against passage of the Violence Against Women Act. And what was notable about this was two things. First, both of these groups are heavily associated with the Tea Party. So what I'm going to tell you now can essentially be said to be the Tea Party position on the Violence Against Women Act. And what these two groups said in public memos, as reported by TPM, is as follows. Heritage declared that the expansive and vague language will increase fraud and false allegations for which there is no legal recourse. Under Violence Against Women Act, men effectively lose their constitutional rights to due process, presumption of innocence, equal treatment under the law, the right to a fair trial, and to confront one accusers. They forfeit the right to bear arms and all custody and visitation rights, the group wrote. It's unprecedented, unnecessary, and dangerous. Now, Freedom Works, for their part, said that they also thought the legislation would be unfair to men, saying, the newest version of the Violence Against Women Act contains very broad and vague definitions of domestic violence. A man that raises his voice at his partner, calls her an offensive name, stalks her, causes her any emotional distress, or simply just annoys her can potentially be prosecuted under the Violence Against Women Act. Calling your spouse a mean name is not advised or polite, but it isn't the same thing as violence toward her. Well, the problem, there are a lot of problems, but the main problem with the Heritage Group and FreedomWorks' crazy claims is that the Violence Against Women Act has been in place for around 28 years and has a track record. The kinds of abuses they claim to be concerned about have not happened. But, you know, it's interesting to see the kinds of things the groups behind the Tea Party are concerned about and how they look at women and women's issues. I mean, the incidences of rape and domestic abuse against women are just way too high in this country. According to the United States Department of Justice document, criminal victimization in the United States, there are overall 191,670 victims of rape or sexual assault reported in 2005. One out of six women and one out of 33 U.S. men have experienced or an attempted or completed rape. In the U.S., domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women between the ages of 15 to 44. And for homicides in which the victim-to-offender relationship could be established, 93% of female victims were murdered by a male that they knew, 63% of them in the context of an intimate relationship. But the groups behind the Tea Party, they don't care about any of that. They're worried about unfairness to men that has not materialized in the 28 years the bill has already been in effect. Very interesting. I know the women of this country find it very interesting, too. They're not going to forget this, my dear Republicans, that I promise you. You're listening to Making Sense with Steve Lazor, and now an update on the attempt to have Chuck Hagel confirmed as Secretary of Defense. When President Obama picked Chuck Hagel to be his next Secretary of Defense to succeed Leon Panetta, you would have thought that a two-term Republican senator wouldn't get much grief from his former GOP colleagues. That's not the case. The nomination of Chuck Hagel has produced one of the oddest spectacles in Washington I have seen. Normally, the Senate does not give a hard time to former senators being confirmed for cabinet positions. That's sort of a gentleman's rule against that. Of course, in the last 30 to 40 years, Republicans have been respecting fewer and fewer gentlemanly rules when a Democrat is president, and the Hagel nomination seems to be the latest casualty. His former colleagues in the Senate have filibustered the first attempt to confirm Mr. Hagel in the Senate. They managed to muster the bare minimum required to filibuster the vote, 41 senators, including Senator John McCain. Now, there are three reasons why this is happening, and none of them really have to do with Mr. Hagel's competence to be Secretary of Defense. I mean, this is what John McCain said when he ran for the Republican nomination in 2000 about Hagel's competence.
As far as Secretary of Defense is concerned, there's a lot of people that could do that. One of them, I think, is Senator Chuck Hagel.
So right there, John McCain is saying that he's competent. I mean, he served in Vietnam, Mr. Hagel did. He won two Purple Hearts awarded, various other awards. I mean, let's start with the fact that the vast amount of the folks filibustering his nomination to be Secretary of Defense, these Republicans, have never served a day in the military. Obviously, John McCain is an exception to that, but most of them have never served. So let's get that hypocrisy out there. But, you know, one of the reasons that Republicans are uncomfortable with Hagel is his opposition to a lot of Bush foreign policies, including the Iraq War and surge. Well, Republicans, I got news for you. In the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll from a month ago, 59% of Americans said the Iraq War was not worth it. And most polls show that number to be between 59% and 67%. That's a huge percentage of Americans that disagree with the major action of our country. And I agree with them. No war is worth the United States of America being thought of as liars. We went to war on a lie. Our government told the whole world to believe us. It wasn't true. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. The Bush administration knew for sure 13 days beforehand, and I'll cover that in an upcoming show. The other two reasons for Republican opposition of Hagel barely deserve mention. One of them is that McCain and others think Hagel has been too friendly with President Obama. McCain particularly holds a grudge against him for stating that he was willing to be Obama's running mate in 2008. You know, it's a whole lot of nonsense. They know Hagel is competent. The nonsense gets worse, though. Republicans are using his nomination to raise the Benghazi issue again. We've had testified before the Senate on this. We've had various others testify before the Senate. The administration has given an accounting to the Senate in writing on its findings in Benghazi. There's no there there, you know. But the Republicans believe this is something they can use to hurt the president, so they're doing it. They're using the nomination, they're holding up the nomination to try to attack the president on Benghazi, even though Hagel had nothing to do with Benghazi. He wasn't in government at the time Benghazi happened. Now, if you understand that, if you understand how ridiculous that is, you understand today's Republican Party and why I think they shouldn't be anywhere near the reins of power in this or any other country. I mean, today's Republican members of the House and Senate aren't fit to argue or decide a kid's newspaper delivery route. That's all I have to say about that. You're listening to Making Sense with Steve Lazor. And now on to our trademark Hall of Fame and shame for those politicians and others making great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. This week, the winner of our Hall of Fame award goes to jointly to Senators Barbara Boxer of California and Bill Nelson of Florida. TPM reported on Tuesday that Senators Boxer and Nelson have co-sponsored an election reform bill that would require the Attorney General to issue new national standards regarding the numbers of voting machines, election workers, and other resources necessary to conduct federal elections. Now, included in those standards would be a requirement that states provide enough voting machines so that no voter will wait in line more than an hour to vote. Now, after what we've gone through in the last 13 years, that's something that we need badly. I'm actually ashamed that hasn't been done a long time ago, but regardless, this is a move that makes exquisite sense. And I thank Senators Boxer and Nelson, and I'm happy to award them this week's Hall of Fame award for making terrific sense. Now, moving on to those who made the Hall of Shame this week for infamous nonsense. In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have the administration at Hurley Medical Center in Michigan. Now, the Daily Mail reported on this. Let me set the scenario for you. A couple comes into hospital, in this case, Hurley Medical Center in Michigan, with the wife in premature labor. The baby's born and taken to the neonatal intensive care unit, where it will spend a certain amount of days or weeks until it's ready to come home. Fine, right? The father allegedly goes to the neonatal ICU to visit the child and notices that there were African-American nurses working there. He allegedly asks to speak with one of the supervisors of the neonatal ICU, and when a supervisor shows up, he allegedly pulls up the sleeve of his shirt to reveal a swastika and demands that no African-Americans take care of his baby. Now, I've worked in a number of places that had strong diversity programs, and the rules are simple. Even if a multi-million dollar recurring client makes the request, you cannot accede to a request like this. It's against the law, and you expose the firm to being sued. In this case, the Hurley Medical Center allegedly agreed to the request and reassigned the nurses to ensure no African-American nurses would take care of the child. Nurse Tanya Battle, who is black, is suing the hospital. In court documents, Nurse Battle indicated that she was shocked, offended, and in disbelief that she was so egregiously discriminated against based on her race and reassigned. It also states in the lawsuit that a staff meeting was held to inform the hospital nurses of the father's demand. That's completely unacceptable behavior. And for it, the Hurley Medical Center is third this week in our Hall of Shame for making nonsense. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Marco Rubio. And it has nothing to do with drinks of water or anything else superficial about his presentation of the rebuttal to President Obama's State of the Union address. Superficial aspects were pretty funny, actually. Sorry, did I just say that? Who cares? It was fun. But no, there were many legitimate and substantial factual reasons to criticize Rubio's speech. Now, Rubio's nonsense spewing reached a crescendo when, as the Comedy Channel's Jon Stewart pointed out, the hypocrisy on government help became overwhelming. Let's listen to Jon Stewart's commentary.
More government isn't going to help you get ahead. It's going to hold you back. More government isn't going to create more opportunities. It's going to limit them. And cue the exact same Republican in the same speech, trying to limit your access to federal help, cataloging the federal help that somehow managed not to hold him back. I believe in federal financial aid. I couldn't have gone to college without it. Medicare. It's especially important to me. It pays for the care my mother receives right now.
But my point is,
because, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of using profanity on radio or television, but Jon Stewart does it so well. And it's bleak, so, you know. In any case, we've seen this before. Republicans who have taken advantage of social programs, they become successful, start businesses. Then they turn around and say, no, you unwashed masses. We're not going to let you have any financial aid for college or Medicare because it's bad for you. It'll hold you back. And as I said, John Stewart's use of profanity is a pretty appropriate response to nonsense like that. And for that, Senator Marco Rubio is runner-up in this week's Hall of Shame for making nonsense. The award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Dick Cheney. AP reports that in a speech to Wyoming Republicans last week, Dick Cheney said that President Barack Obama has jeopardized U.S. national security by nominating substandard candidates for key cabinet posts and by degrading the U.S. military. Mr. Cheney said, quote, "The performance now of Barack Obama as he staffs up the national security team for the second term is dismal." He said it was dismal, and he went on to say that it was vital to the nation's national security that, quote, good folks hold the position of Secretary of State, CIA Director, and Secretary of Defense. But frankly, what he has appointed are second-rate people, Mr. Cheney said, speaking of President Obama. Now, the last CBS New York Times poll in 2009 at the end of his presidency showed that 73% of people disapproved of George W. Bush's handling of his job. Dick Cheney's unfavorable rating since leaving office has hovered between 53 and 57%, and only between 34% and 39% of the people of this country have a favorable opinion of him. I have to say to the former vice president, what are you afraid of, Mr. Cheney? Are you afraid that someone on President Obama's national security team is going to ignore three separate written warnings that someone's about to attack the United States? That they're going to get so annoyed with verbal warnings from the CIA that they're going to throw the director of the CIA out of their office one of the times that they come to bring you the latest warning? Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. I forgot. That happened during the administration that you were a part of, Dick. And the result was that terrorists were able to attack us and kill nearly 3,000 Americans in the continental United States. But wait, maybe, Mr. Cheney, you're afraid that the current administration will lie us into a war with a country that did not attack us. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry, I forgot. That was your administration, too, wasn't it, Mr. Cheney? So let me say this once to Mr. Cheney, to George W. Bush, and all the former members of that administration. You performed so badly on every aspect of your jobs, from defense and national security to the economy to everything else, that you need to sit down and shut up and be thankful that so far at least, several of you haven't been prosecuted for war crimes. For the shameful temerity that anyone with a track record like Mr. Cheney would try to besmirch anyone else's national security team, it's a no-brainer. Dick Cheney wins this week's Hall of Shame for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for this evening. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Lazor will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time this Sunday, February 24th. Until next time, have a great rest of your evening and a great week.